Okay, so good morning, everybody. So I would like to talk a bit about today what you can learn from a sexual organism, and I also learned that I should basically take the opportunity first to acknowledge the people that have been doing the work. So I will be mainly talking about the. Now this doesn't work any longer. That's interesting. Just worked beforehand. So basically, I will be talking about the stuff from François, Anna Langmüller, Ray Tobler, Suse Franzen, and Neda. So they're basically here. So just kind of that I have acknowledged this. Now this stopped working as well. Okay. Okay, good. Maybe there's no battery. Good. So, okay, basically, also what has been a common theme is that you basically have to, go to a psychiatrist and explain why I'm working with Drosophila and explain all your problems. So I thought, rather than explaining my problems, I basically go to and show you a version of an Austrian artist, Franz West, of the version of the bed of Sigmund Freud, which you find at the Sigmund Freud Museum in Vienna. So this is basically where I go and tell you where my therapy, why I'm working with Drosophila, what's wrong with me not working with proper eukaryotes. And so one of the answers I'm saying, well, it's obvious if you look at this fantastic creature. It's just beautiful. Why not work with something like this? But I put this for another reason. It's kind of obvious that what Drosophila has, all the microbes don't have, they have a proper phenotype. So you can really look at different organs, you can look at different parts of the morphology, and you can have real phenotypes to study, classic phenotypes to study, how they may change and being basically contributing to adaptation. And the other reason why to work with fruit flies is, of course, they are recombining. So this is another good motivation for working with fruit flies. So, and what I've also learned here that I should ask simple questions. I'm also trying to do this, to come up with a simple question, and so I'm just asking, well, how are flies adapting when I put them to a new temperature regime? So this sounds like a simple question to me, at least it sounded to me like a simple question when I started with this. The thing is, however, adaptation to temperature, from the literature we know this is a very complex trait. Basically, every study that tries to make a QTL study trying to find genes involved in temperature resistance comes up with other different genes, many different genes. And so there are several been identified. Very few of them can be reproduced. So this is maybe not so simple as it may seem at the first glance. And the other thing is, what may not be so simple is basically, what's then the genetic architecture? Should we believe in an infinitesimal model? Or is there more like the classic thing, like Darwinian selection, where we have selective sweeps, that some alleles are just sweeping, could be hard sweeps or soft sweeps, whatever, but basically where you assume a constant S. So what is the setup of our experiment? And I would say the major difference here is in this part, that we go out in the wild and we collect a natural population. And we bring single inseminated females to the lab, put them in plastic containers where we basically can propagate them as long as we wish. And so we try to do this for a very short period of time, something like 5 generations, just to make sure that they don't bring any diseases that we could spot and they are the right species. And then what we did, we used for one experiment, we used something like a bit more than 100 of these isofemale lines. For the other ones and the other species, we were more using above 200. And then it's a very simple thing. We set up base populations all starting from the same isofemale line, so we can really try to minimize the heterogeneity among the replicate populations by using the same isofemale lines. And then we run a certain number of replicates, 3, 5, whatever we've done. It varies between experiments. And then we keep them at a population size to 1,000 to 1,250, roughly for a set of generations. And then we could have the opportunity to do at the beginning pool seek to get the allele frequencies, and at the end, and maybe also in between, that we can do time series. And we have two, yeah?
Can I just make sure I understand? So you have 113 individual females, each of which founds one of these replicates.
Mm-hmm.
Each of these just comes directly from the wild.
After five generations, yeah. So they have been basically, you have brother, sister, five generations of brother, sister mating. Okay. That's it. So there is a bit of...
And then you found the 113.
Exactly. Okay. And we found them with a single female, but basically if you want to find 500, then it's roughly five females from one isofemale line that start basically the base population, that we can get up to the numbers immediately, that we don't have to amplify it during the experiment.
So you have this natural population, you sample, you have a single population that you inbreed for five generations, and then you take, what, five females, you say?
Yeah, it's a, whatever you call it, I call it an isofemale line, so not a, we take 100, you collect 100 females, each of the females gets into a separate vial, there it does five generations brother-sister mating while we are checking for infection and species. And then out of this isofemale line, we take five females for each of the replicates to found the replicates. Ah, there's another one. Excellent. Good. Thank you.
And then the fact that it's 113 is completely irrelevant.
Yeah. So you take five overall and not five from each of the 114.
I take in total 500, and they come from 100 isofemale lines. Each female... From a line, we have 500, so in total 500 females start an a replicate population.
Okay, so five from each of the 114.
Yes.
So the idea is you're making five haplotypes, or you're making 100 haplotypes,
yeah.
And then you're going to amplify that up.
But the isofemale lines are not,
they're not close to.
Yeah.
No way,
they're very different.
If you keep them for five generations, they...
I know, but I'm just saying that's the spirit of it, right?
The spirit of it, yeah.
Oops, so now this is...
You didn't do strict brother-sister, right?
Just no.
Oh, wait, did you just maintain the lines?
We just maintained them. We did not aim to inbreed, just the opposite. We wanted to maintain as much of the variation as possible.
I don't understand why they're not inbreed.
Yeah. They're inbred, but there's a ton of variation in a single cross.
Yeah.
And then he's not taking a single brother and sister five generations. So you're maintaining a bunch of variation.
Yeah. It's a population of 50 to 100 flies or whatever.
Enough of them that they're going to mix freely.
You don't lose much variation in this phase. And actually, if you keep isofemale lines for very long, it's very hard to completely inbreed them, which is another topic. Yeah.
We sequenced stocks from the Bloomington Stock Center that were effectively isofemale lines collected in the 1960s, and they still had boatloads of those.
And if you inbreed them, they die. So that's okay, good. So we have this setup. So this is kind of something that has been also introduced to you multiple times. This is a Manhattan plot where we basically use the statistics across the replicates to look for consistent allele frequency changes, and where we find a very strong, pronounced, and consistent allele frequency changes across replicates, we get a very high peak here. And so this is basically what you see. These are the different chromosomes from Drosophila, and the peaks high up there would indicate something significant. And what's highlighted here in green is something that we've been talking as well. This is a count-based p-value. And so there are two regions that basically have an amplification of the genome. And therefore, you have a higher copy number. And there you get really these nice outliers here, despite there's no allele frequency difference. So that's kind of why it's green. You shouldn't look at it. But what you should look at is the two different levels of red, indicating that for these SNPs, you find more allele frequency changes than you would expect under drift. And so this suggests that we have a massive number of putative targets of selection. And this is several hundreds, yeah. So it's really massive, much more than you would be inclined to believe. So the question is this has been coming up all over. You've seen it in Molly's data. This is wherever a Drosophila study, I think there's only one exception that did it. For Drosophila melanogaster, there was always the surplus of candidate loci, even if you account for drift. So there is something what we're missing, and there was one paper by Sergey and Tom that basically proposed a simple way to do this, to get this, is if we don't treat the SNPs as independent, but rather they're linked. So if you have linked SNPs, then you don't need as many targets of selection. And, but the idea in Drosophila was we have very low LD, so we should basically can treat every SNP as independent. And what they say, well, maybe if it is not the case, then if you have a haplotype increasing, then you will find a lot of linked SNPs, and they all show a signature of selection. So you may have much fewer targets of selection than these analyses suggest. So what we did, we asked, well, what is really happening to linkage disequilibrium in these populations? So we basically looked at the beginning, what is our pattern of linkage disequilibrium, the different colors, or the different chromosomes, and you see a very typical pattern for Drosophila with a very quick drop in linkage disequilibrium. So these are 200 base pairs, and then basically you get to the base level of your LD, yeah?
Is the base level what you'd expect based on...
The base level, what you expect, depends on where you cut or do draw your cutoff for the low frequency ones and the number of chromosomes you put in. But basically, if you go further, it really levels out here below 0.2 for this data set.
If you compare it with cross chromosome
LT, it would be also closer to 0.2, below 0.2. But this depends on number of chromosomes you're looking at and also where you draw your cutoff for the low frequency variants. Basically, if you apply the same procedure after almost 70 generations, you see that the overall picture has basically unchanged. The only thing is you see a slight shift upwards. There's a little bit of increase in LD, but you still see that's really low and doesn't look like as if this could explain the high number of selection targets. Another way to look at this is this analysis that has been done by Ray, and where he basically superimposed all the significant SNPs that he found and looked then around these ones, how much deviation from neutralities do I see around this SNP. And this is what he's plotting here. So these are all candidates SNPs superimposed, and you move out to the left and to the right, and you see what is the signal. And this is average. So you see very quickly this signal of significance drops when you move away from the outlier. So this is not a signal that persists many base pairs away, it really drops very quickly. This doesn't depend whether you look at a hot evolved or a cold evolved cage. It's a very consistent pattern, and it's around 200 base pairs, what people always say is the magic number for drop of linkage disequilibrium, consistent with what you see here. After 200 base pairs, you're very close to the background linkage disequilibrium in the population. So well, this suggested, well, where does the linkage come from? This is not really clear. If you look at neighboring SNPs, they don't show this signal. And Ray invested this a bit further. What he had now, he split the data into, he had five replicates, split them into three and two, and asked, well, how consistent is the signal I'm getting for the outliers for these? And so he basically was plotting them against this, and kind of, and everything that's above the diagonal indicates an enrichment for these ones. And you see, yes, for both cages, hot is the hot environment, cold is the cold environment, you see some consistency. It's not overwhelming, I would say it's quite appalling, but you still find some signal. So then he was saying, well, okay, so what could this be? So he first excluded regions where we know that we expect more linkage disequilibrium. This means regions with lower recombination rate, where we have in Drosophila, like Tony also discussed this, there are some regions that have lower recombination rates and some have higher. So he excluded them. And you can see, yeah, if you exclude them, suddenly your enrich as your consistency really goes down, but it still persists. There is still a signal. And then he said, well, if I think this is all driven by selection, can I do this if I'm looking at sites where I know they can't be selected? So remember, the idea is you hit the right target of selection, so only these show the signal. So he was saying, now, what would be if I use regions where people assume they're not selected and there's a short intrans in Drosophila? So this is the general consensus. This is as good as you can get for something neutral in a Drosophila genome. He did it again. And yes, it gets a bit weaker, but you still see an enrichment of sites that show parallel signature across these split experiment, suggesting, well, this can't be selection because these sites are neutral. So it must be something else.
Christian, you sorted the SNPs on the x-axis according to the p-values?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. It's like a rock curve, yeah. Mm-hmm. So basically, What he looked at then is kind of, can we have something that could explain it? And he put basically these indications here around or along the genome where you have segregating inversions. And you see that in particular on this chromosome arm on 3R, there is in fact a large number of segregating inversions that could basically prevent recombination. And if you think that's, yeah, there is also enrichment of candidates. So this could be that inversions are contributing to the signal we're getting. But another, I think, probably much more important reasons why we get this signal of the large number of SNPs is a frequency increase of a low-frequency haplotype. And this is indicated here. So you may have a haplotype that has, in red, indicated SNPs that are specific to this single haplotype. They don't occur on the other haplotypes. So if this one goes up in frequency, and if this can go up quite quickly, if because you have only a few generations, moderate population size. So basically, if this is the target of selection, it drags all the other SNPs that are specific for this haplotype along. And so what you will get is that basically not just this one, but also this one and this one and this one will show the signature of selection. And why does it not, and how does, is this compatible with the other pattern? Because for linkage disequilibrium, you also look at this SNP, you look at this SNP, etc., and they don't show anything. Because there you see no difference in linkage disequilibrium. So this explains if around the target of selection you see this very quick drop, because you look at all other SNPs that are not associated with the low frequency haplotype that increases in frequency.
So if you did your signal decay curve conditional on the SNP having a very similar frequency?
Well, we haven't done this, but I show you something similar what we use then later on for this signal. Yeah.
Sorry, I'm a little lost. So have little evidence for strong linkage disequilibrium across mm-hmm. the entire genome. And yet, you do have regions of low recombination which should be in linkage disequilibrium being selected.
So these ones here, yeah? Or you mean the
previous slide?
Well, the inversions is really complicated because the inversions themselves have polymorphism that's segregating. Okay, there is some shared variation.
There's a combination going on within the inversions as well, which gives you overall that
load. On the long-term evolutionary timescale, you find exchanges. But in the cages, I don't think that we have recombination among the inversions, but they will suppress recombination on top of this. So that's. But it's not the major explanation for the signal. It's just something that's contributing to this.
Sure.
No. I think that's the major reason, yeah?
And just on this graph, you said the blue haplotype, the blue mutation in the middle is selected?
No. One of the red ones.
One of the red ones, okay.
Sorry, Maud?
Yeah, I'm just wondering, how about background selection?
It's always there, but this will not contribute to the signal that we're having. So I don't think that this is an explanation for it. We cannot rule out, but I don't think it's a major force. I show you. Let me continue. So if you think that this is the explanation, we did some simulations. Just assuming you have a low starting frequency that goes up. Low frequency haplotype that goes up, and then we just basically indicated this, and yeah, that's basically what you see here. You get a very similar signature with just a single haplotype increasing in frequency. This looks qualitatively very similar to what we see in a Drosophila result. So we have to really rethink on what we can do and what we have to how we have to analyze the data, because yes, just simple analysis of doing it SNP-wise is not going to work. And another reason why melanogaster is problematic, as I mentioned, this is basically a level of polymorphism, and you can see these valleys around the centromeres towards the end of the chromosomes, because there you have very low recombination, and so you also don't have much variation. So you see that's very heterogeneous, and there are large regions in the Drosophila melanogaster genome that have really low recombination. So if you have a beneficial mutation here, it's very, very difficult to really locate this beneficial mutation. So that's why NEDA came up with a suggestion, well, we shouldn't use melanogaster because it's not a good species if you want to localize targets of selection, but rather you should use a close relative, Drosophila simulans, which has a more homogeneous rate of recombination and no segregating inversions, large segregating inversions. So it may be much better and may give much cleaner signals. Okay, so from now on, I will forget. You can forget about melanogaster. I will talk about simulants. Yeah.
Why does simulants not have large segregating inverse?
That's a very good question. I would love to know. It's melanogaster, but then Morishana has no segregating inversions. Seychellia, well, it's not very polymorphic, and simulants, no segregating variation. So it's a phylogenetic signal that you find there.
And these are just inversions that are observed in natural populations,
yes.
Not the induced inversions.
No, not induced.
And this has been the fact that they're absent or minimal in simulants has been deduced how? By
chromosomes clashes. Yeah. Just classic work, not done by us. Okay. So what I would like to talk now about is simulants, and I would like to talk a bit about dialectic things. So this is kind of, I don't have to explain, this is something, a way to discuss science, approaches to science. It dates back to the Greek and Romans, but of course I'm emphasizing the German philosophers, Johann Gottlieb Fichte and Hegel, that were really the drivers of shaping this concept of dialectic. And so what is dialectic about? Oops. It's basically the concept is that you have a thesis, so you propose an argument, and this argument is basically countered with an antithesis, and then you have a lot of conflict between the thesis and antithesis, and then because of this conflict, you end up with something that's on a higher level, getting closer to the truth, and then you can continue with thesis and antithesis again with a synthesis. And so what I would like to discuss with you, how can we link this concept to our Drosophila data? Okay, good. So let's talk again about the experimental design we have for Drosophila simulants. It's very similar what we had. We have basically collected the flies. Now they were collected in Portugal. We have 250 lines. I will mainly talk about the hot environment. This is roughly a bit more than 60 generations. What we do with them, we do whole genome sequencing, as you've been seeing. I will be talking about RNA-seq data as well as some phenotypes. So what you expect if you have your flies evolving, yes, they should basically increase in fitness. And that's exactly what we see. Basically, we measure fitness by the eggs being laid per female. Then you see this is the ancestral variation, the cold, and the hot one and increases 23 constant. I should say the temperature treatment that we were doing is not constant 23, but it's basically fluctuating. And this is just in the middle of these two temperatures. And so what's interesting, if you do the fitness assay not a constant temperature, but a fluctuating one, you see still that the hot is better, but the cold has a different fitness. So the explanation is that some of the adaptation is also due to the rapid fluctuation we have in our cages, but that's nothing I will be covering. But I think it's a very nice side aspect.
That 15 eggs a day seems really low for a female. That's what they do, yeah.
That's kind of... okay, so now if you have seen the melanogaster Manhattan plot, you will really appreciate what we see in simulants. This is really beautiful. So this is the line after basically looking for drift, etc., what you would like to have. And so you see that we have maybe four or five chimneys. So this is very, very different. And these chimneys basically can be localized. I would like to basically focus the attention on these two chimneys here that contain two major genes, sestrine and SNF4. So, but, yeah?
So I don't understand. You just showed that, or you just argued for the presence of this low frequency haplotype that you cannot do with R squared.
I should see them there. Yeah, if you wait a bit, it may be that we were just lucky. This is.
Is the threshold a lot different for simulants than for melanogaster? The reason I remember it being at like 10 or something.
Yeah, this depends on the coverage and all these things. So don't take this. It's basically the drift simulations take into account the coverage heterogeneity we're having, the effective population size estimate. So there are a lot of factors going into this, but I think it's mainly coverage what is the issue. The other one was older, so we have a higher coverage with this. Yes, so basically to give you a better idea how it looks like, when you go here, this is the gene plotted again, and this R is a zoom in, so you can see here the outliers, and you really see that we can relatively well localize where these SNPs are. So it's basically, we can really zoom in where the target of selection is. It's, yeah, there are three minor genes, not really clear what they're doing, but this is the SNF4 indicating. So we could say that we would be able to localize our target of selection somewhere here. So just talking about what is happening in the replicates, this is a very nice parallel signature we're seeing. These are the candidate SNPs mapping, falling into this region. So you see in all five replicates, they increase in frequency relatively, I don't know, 30% or something like this in 60 generations. This is quite a massive increase in frequency. And it's nice in parallel signature. Same thing for Sestrin. There are more SNPs in this region, but you still see a very nice parallel response in all the five replicates that we've been using. And we can use these ones to estimate the selection that's operating on them. And so these are different SNPs, and these are your posterior distributions. So you can see this is roughly, I don't know, 5%, 6% selection coefficient. So really strong selection operating on both genes. So what are these genes doing? And I would like to focus your attention to Sestrin. It's also called AMPK in the literature. It's called for AMP activated protein kinase. And this gene is, for a physiologist, an animal physiologist, really exciting, because this is a gene that is well studied and it has a central role controlling the metabolism of an organism. So it basically measures the AMP to ATP ratio in the cell. And depending on the AMP to ATP ratio, it basically, either when it's activated, you have fatty acid oxidation, or the opposite, you basically build up fatty acids. And so there's also a 5' region where you have alternative splicing that regulates the sensitivity, etc. But what's important is that this AMPK is composed of this SN4 gamma that we have been identifying, plus other units. But what's also interesting, Sestrin, our second candidate, modulates the phosphorylation rate of AMPK. So it really zooms in on a single molecule that seems to do the job. Out of four peaks, we have basically two candidate loci that basically all zoom in the same process. So you may ask, what is this process doing? So one way to address this would be RNA-seq. So what we did, RNA-seq of at 23 degrees, comparing the ancestral population against the evolved ones, and evolved hot one and the evolved cold one. And then what you can see here, this is basically glycolysis. And you see here, this is basically the difference of the hot evolved compared to the base. And the cold evolved in blue, base in green. And so what you see is that basically right from here on, you find significant differences along these ones, or you can see it here also. And they all go in exactly the same direction, suggesting that the metabolism is down-regulated downstream of a gene that is directly targeted by the AMPK. So this gene that we have identified based on the genomic data, if you look at the transcription data, everything downstream from this seems to be affected by this, really providing strong evidence that we have really identified something that is a major regulator of the metabolism. And you could go further. You could look for the oxidative phosphorylation or the TCA cycle. The signal is always the same. The hot evolved ones are downregulated compared to either cold or the ancestral, yeah?
So if you go and look at other things in that pathway now as candidates, and go back to the genomic data, do you see any signal in any of them?
It doesn't look like. It seems really to be driven by these by these two genes of related to the metabolism. But I will a bit later. I will get back to this question, and you will see why. I think it's a very good point.
And if you alter AMPK activity in melanogaster, will they be more fit in your hot or cold regime?
We haven't done it. The question is how. Yeah, it's something we could do. It's a huge gene. that's why it looks so zoomed in, but it's really big. It's something 80 kb or something in size. So it's
is
a
that
bit
because of introns or regular.
Yeah, because of introns. It's a bit difficult to manipulate. Yeah. Good. So if you could continue this, then we could basically look at the fat metabolism genes and insulin signaling, just again emphasizing the importance of metabolism, which has been changed. So my guess for you, if you think everything is down-regulated on the metabolism, on the transcript level, what would the influence on respiration, this means CO2 production, what would you guess? What? No guesses? That's good. So you have no hypothesis, you're not biased by results. My guess was that the CO2 production should go down. In fact, what we see is the opposite. It's significant, the difference. It goes up. Of course, it's a very high order phenotype. Many other things could be going on. So maybe it's beta chain oxidation, whatever that produces the CO2. We don't know. But what's important, I think, that you still see a consistent change of the hot evolved compared to the two others. And it's also important that this change is very consistent across all the five replicates. I don't show this, but you have to believe me. So we see also on the respiration level that these flies are making changes in the metabolism by using CO2 production. Okay, so what I've shown you so far, that we get a very consistent signal, it looks convincing, at least to me. We have a strong selection signature, but the question is, this is something that goes on in the lab under completely artificial conditions. Is this an artifact that we are seeing by our lab cultures, or is it something that we could link to natural populations? So the challenge, of course, what would you do? You would basically take the causative SNP and look at natural populations. The caveat is we haven't mapped the causative SNP. So it's a bit difficult. So the way that Francois addressed this, he said, well, I don't have the causative SNP, but I have a haplotype. And I know that this haplotype has been selected. So he's looking, basically, is there this haplotype somehow preserved in natural populations, and does it vary across clinal populations? Because you have intracephaly, you have this cline from hot to cold environment, so you would predict if AMPK is really so important for temperature response that this would matter, match this pattern. And so he was basically asking, if I take all my candidate SNPs that I can also detect in clinal populations, do I find evidence for these total set of SNPs for clinality more than I would expect by chance? And these are the allele frequencies he finds in Maine and in Florida. So this goes exactly in the right direction as you would expect it. Difference is not very big, I perfectly accept this. But you have to see, this is not a target of selection. This assumes that these SNPs are still a linkage, this equilibrium with the true target of selection. And then he did some permutations and asking, well, if I look for clinality in these populations, and then you see this is basically where his set of SNPs ends up, and this is basically the background. So showing that at least this combination of SNPs, despite making a strong assumption of being on the same haplotype, show more clinality than you would expect by chance from this natural population. So this is some evidence that we think that the same haplotype is basically also conserved in the natural populations and is changing in frequency between northern and southern populations.
Christian, why do you make the assumption that it should be higher in Florida than in Maine? I didn't follow that.
Well, and because in Florida it's warmer than in Maine, so this is the hot.
Sorry.
But you detected it first from a Portugal population, right?
Yeah.
So population that is in not necessarily the same gene that is adapted worldwide. I mean, it could be a local adaptation in Portugal.
Exactly, but then you wouldn't expect to find a clinal pattern.
No, I mean, at first to test this, even if you didn't find anything, doesn't mean that in Portugal it's not happening.
That's true. If you would have a negative result, I would have perfectly accepted your hypothesis, not have taken this. But as we find this other one, I think it's even more surprising. I find it actually surprising that the haplotype is conserved. And we looked a bit in detail in some of our other data, and we find that a whole chunk of this haplotype is preserved in Florida flies. So it's not complete bogus what he has identified there. So, and other support for that, this is a real we have a real link to natural populations. If you look among the genes without going for SNP variants, SNF4, the SNP variants that we have identified, SNF4 is one of the most clonal genes in Drosophila melanogaster. It's among the most clonal genes in Drosophila simulans. Also interestingly, this gene also varies seasonally in Drosophila melanogaster, but many genes do so, a little bit. And what's also interesting, the SNF4 expression in Drosophila subobscura basically matches also the patterns that we see with a low expression in southern population. So it seems to be that this is not just a lab artifact that we identified, but it's something that we see in natural populations. We identified something. So it really looks cool. So this gets me down to the thesis .
So then do you predict or do you have any evidence that there's lower allele variation in things like Sechelia or Erecta that are not living, that where you, there's no real temperature clients for those guys?
We haven't looked at this. So we haven't looked at this. Okay. Sechelia has little variation, so we would need to do it in Mauritiana.
Just for that. Yeah.
But we haven't done it. So basically, what is the conclusion? We basically have adaptation to temperature. We find high convergence ranging from genes to phenotypes and fitness. Only a few loci with rather strong fitness effects drive this adaptation. Adaptation in laboratory captures processes in natural populations. So it's good to do experimental evolution. It has some important links to ecology. But what I would also like to discuss is you've seen that the whole pathway is being affected. And if you're asking, well, this is actually driving adaptation, this experiment is pretty uninformative. So it's basically we have our ancestral populations. We have three replicates. This will be different pathways. So this is our glycolysis. And we see basically in each of the replicates, we see the same response somewhere in the pathway. We see the response and everything downstream is being affected. So yeah, this parallelism is nice. It gives us comfort because we can reproduce it across replicates, but it doesn't allow us to move to the next level. Because in principle, it's nice to see genomic signatures, but after all, I would like to know, well, what the heck is the actually selected trait? What needs to change to make the flies fitter in a hot environment compared to the ancestral ones? Okay, so this was a thesis. So let's now move to the antithesis. This is another population, another experiment. This is analyzed mainly by NEDA. So it's also Drosophila simulans, but now we have a founder population from Florida in the United States. It's a similar number of founders, 200. It's a similar experiment. It just has evolved because after Robert has done his simulations, we recognized maybe we should do more replicates. So we basically doubled the number of replicates. We went from 5 to 10. And the other difference is, beforehand, we were just looking at the beginning of the experiment and the end, after whatever 60 generations. But here, NEDA also has sampled every 10th generation, so we have nice time series data where we could basically follow the trajectories, alleles, over time. Okay, what we find is...
How many generations?
60 or so. So it's all roughly 60. Magic number where we do the analysis cutoff. It's just they still continue evolving, which is good and bad. Again, you see here, this is the egg lay of the ancestor, and these are the evolved ones. So you can see, particularly in the early days, this is when we basically use the flies to set up the next generation, we have an increased fitness. And also, if you average across the whole time, you still find that the hot evolved are fitter. Again, it would be scary not to have a fitness increase. What we also see is that CO2 production, if you look in the females, is being increased in the hot evolved ones. The interesting thing is we don't see it in the males. This is also across the replicates where you see this, just showing that this is a very consistent trend, that the phenotype is different across the replicates. NEDA also scored lipid content, and you can see that the lipid content consistently is reduced in the females, again not in the males, and the signal is quite significant across the replicates. I should say what she did in addition, I had no slide for this, the previous population, she also scored for lipid content and saw the same pattern But now for males and females, as with CO2 production, it's reduced in the hot evolved flies. So this suggests these two separate experiments from two different founders evolved to the same high order for phenotypes. So the question is, how do they look like on a genomic level? And so now this is the picture that Neda got. It's still much better than what you find from Melanogaster, because you have a very nice peaked structure here. But it's obvious, if you look at this, that there seems to be much more going on than what we had in the other population. So you may say, well, this is because now we've increased the number of replicates, we have more power to detect this. Of course, this was the first thing Neda looked at. When she looks at five, it looks very similar. So this is not the explanation for this. But how to process with this, how to proceed? I've shown you that you should not look at SNPs because it's not a good idea. So in principle, if we believe all what the GWAS studies are doing, we would say one peak here is basically containing linked SNPs, and they should basically correspond to one target of selection, and this is expected to be somewhere up in the peak. Yeah, this is the naive expectation. But then you may say, yeah, we can go here, 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 but where else, where do you draw the boundary? Where is the peak ending and where does it stop? So we need to have a better way to identify what is the genomic region being affected by a selective event. And so this is a method that Suse came up with, with Nick Barton. Basically, it's very simple, and you can think of it, is, as I said, if something starts from a low frequency, you have all these linked SNPs that are specific to this haplotype, and then they basically behave exactly the same across replicates. And if you have replicate data, like you have five replicates and you have time series, so all what you need to basically extract are SNPs from all the sets of SNPs that you have that basically have a correlation in their allele frequency changes across the entire experiment. So extract SNPs that basically have a similar allele frequency, and you can do this with clustering. So you basically cluster all your SNPs into groups, and each group would then basically correspond to a single haplotype or a family of haplotypes that share SNPs that are largely specific to this set of haplotypes. And so this is a way how you could delineate what such a chromosome would look like. And so this is what Neda has been doing. This is one chromosome. I think chromosome or chromosome arm, anyway. And so what you can see here is kind of interesting. So first look at this is the first cluster that she has identified where she finds them to be correlated. This indicates that the naive assumption that every chimney here that we see corresponds to a separate target of selection is completely wrong. It indicates that they all cluster together and they have only a single target of selection. And so you can go through and you will find several of these incidences where well-separated chimneys are clustered together, indicating that they have the same underlying haplotype that is being selected. And so what, yeah?
This is all short-read data, though?
All short-read data.
Cool.
No.
Yeah, pull short-read.
But what you can do with this is that Neda started to look at her chimneys or clusters that she identified across the replicates. So she has 10 replicates. This is the CMH test giving you the Manhattan plot. And now you can zoom in on this region here and ask, what is the trajectories of the allele, are the trajectories of these alleles generating this chimney? And what you can see is that the behavior of this replicate is very different from some of the others. So it's what we've seen beforehand, that we had our chimneys producing very parallel responses in selection. What Neda sees now is there's a huge heterogeneity among these ones. There's a very local thing that one replicate shows a very strong behavior, whereas in the other one you don't see anything. So this is really changing the whole ballpark that the whole evolve and resequencing field was relying on. We've discussed this one several times, that you look for a parallel signature. But now we have clear signature of non-parallelism, indicating that in some replicates something is happening, versus in the other ones, starting from the same variation, nothing seems to be happening.
Okay, just to understand, the higher peak, in the higher peaks you have something that is much more repeatable. Is this because it's a lower peak, and would you have picked it up before with your threshold or no?
Yeah, yeah, Neda would have. She identified this as a significant cluster. This is a property of the CMH test that you may like or may dislike. If you have some heterogeneity, if a few replicates give a very strong signal, the CMH would still pick this out as something. But it also says that the CMH may not be the best way to look at your data. That's pretty obvious. So you should no longer look for a consistent signal, but that's what we did in the beginning, yeah?
So in the previous experiment, you had five replicates.
Yes.
So what is the probability that you would see five replicates that behave in the same way?
Let me wait a bit, and I have basically probably more data to show this, but it's a good question. So you basically say with five, you wouldn't have seen it, yeah.
Do you have a sense of how low frequency the variant has to be in the beginning for this field block?
It depends on the selection coefficient. But I have also some data where you can see something, but it clearly depends on the selection coefficient. Yeah, so the advantage if you use a CMH test, you only need a weak change. When it's consistent across replicates, you pick it up. Or if you have a strong one and a few ones, you also pick it up. But that's...
I was referring to the sort of haplotype, the correlated change in allele frequency. It seems like that's going to work well when the selected variant is rare, and so it can be in sort of strong...
It works much better. But the other one, I show you some data. It also seems to work a bit when the frequency is higher. But it's more challenging because you have fewer private SNPs to the family of haplotypes. So that's what it looks like when you basically get away from the analysis of all haplotypes together, but analyze each of the replicates separately using whatever Fisher's exactor, chi-square, whatever you like to know. And I think you don't need much statistics if you compare the Manhattan plots here, which are clearly much noisier than the CMH, but you can really see that you have a pig chimney here, it's not there, it's not there, it's not there, it's really local. This one is also absent here, not here. You have one here that's not there. So wherever you go, you find huge heterogeneity among the replicates. Really consistent one, what we saw before. So every replicate seems to be doing different things. So if we go for Neda's way for analyzing the clusters, you have a way to basically count your targets of selection, and you can ask in how many replicates or in which replicates does each of the clusters occur. In total, she has identified 99 of these clusters, and if you look at this on average, you have something between 40 and 50 of these clusters. This means targets of selection in each of the replicates. So it's a very similar number of targets of selection in all the replicates, but they can be differing quite a bit. And so this is what we have here. This is a plot where you basically look at the mean starting frequency of each of the clusters across the 10 replicates. What's the starting frequency, and then what is the probability that you find it in several replicates? So this is basically the ones that occur only in a single replicate, and these ones will be here the ones that occur in all 10 replicates. Yeah.
Yeah. Just to make sure I follow, what you call a cluster of selection is many different alleles that whose allele frequencies are correlated, right?
Exactly.
But
exactly.
I wasn't entirely sure why you said there would be a C. You said there would be a single determinant for that? Or you said that if in many places the allele frequencies are correlated, it means there's only one target of selection?
It's a conservative assumption. You could also have two. You could also have two or whatever. That's
on
the same haplotype. But
something that behaves.
Yes. So I have no way to resolve this. But if you think you have in total 100, and we have 10 replicates, and we start with 200 times two, whatever, or three chromosomes. So it's not very likely that you find many of them being on the same chromosome if they're randomly distributed. But you could, for every reason, think that they could be for past history of the population. Still, some alleles doing the same, from different loci doing the same thing, being linked together. That's something we cannot resolve.
Anyway, the cluster you're analyzing here are covariation.
Yes.
Covariation of allele frequencies.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
So, okay. It's still a little bit related. Do you condition on starting starting?
No. It's basically the way she uses the SNPs to cluster is they need to have a certain allele frequency change or significant. They need to be significant with a very liberal significance, I don't know, 10% or something, at least in one of the replicates using the Fisher's exact or the CMH test, because the CMH test basically would look for a consistent signal across all the replicates that doesn't need to be so pronounced. So just to basically maximize the power to detect something. And then I think it's kind of obvious. Also, you see that very few are basically detected. It's only one of these 100 or 99 clusters that is detected in all replicates. And there is I think if you have something like 30% that occur in less than 5 replicates. So it's a massive number of heterogeneity across the different replicates in terms of the selection trajectories. You can also ask, well, what is the selection coefficient with the different, depending, what's the correlation, the relationship between the selection coefficient and the number of replicates? So you find that the ones that you only find have the strongest selection coefficient that are only occurring in one or a few replicates, and then it goes down. There can be all kind of artifacts because I don't know what I would expect. Yes, the thing is, you could argue that there is a bias because only the very strong ones will be detected eventually. On the other hand, if you think that these are the selection coefficients, you don't see these ones in the common ones either. So I don't think that this is an entire bias, but it's very difficult to get rid of this bias that you have. Of course, if something is only occurring in a single replicate, it needs to be really strong that we identify. But nevertheless, we don't have these high selection coefficients.
Is there estimation bias as well?
What do you mean by estimation bias?
I mean, if the true selection coefficient for all of them is 5%, some alleles are going to spread faster than they should by selection alone. And those are the ones you detect.
It's also, we cannot rule it out, yes. I think we have to do more simulations to basically make strong statements about that. But I think it's a very interesting distribution, and your point is a valid one, yeah.
Eventually you have more variance below the curve on the left-hand side, maybe you have no power, but on the right-hand side you have. So here
exactly, exactly. But still, the point is still valid. If we estimate selection coefficients across the replicates, we may average this more out. So we should probably also estimate selection coefficients on individual replicates and get the distribution then and see maybe we get high ones here as well. This is something we should do, yeah.
But if you believe these selection coefficients at face value, they should be moving around pretty big hunks of DNA, right?
Yes.
Centimorgan-sized hunks.
Yeah. We have this. Well, I left this slide out, but some of them are really up to 5-6 megabases.
Right.
So they can be really big, but the majority is considerably smaller. I want to make a point is that despite this goes down, if you see the selection coefficient is still huge. We talk about 5% for the small ones. It's really massive selection we're having in these populations. At least for sexual organisms, this is really massive selection. And for a large number of loci, this is completely screwing up our perspective of what we think is segregating in natural populations. It's just where we think, well, maybe if you think in the infinitesimal model, we have large number of very small effect ones. Now we have a moderately high number of massive effect ones that we detect. So it's really, there is something much different in this population than our assumptions were basically previously. So just to basically recap the antithesis, adaptation to temperature, we find convergence high levels, fitness, CO2 production, lipid content. We have a low convergence at the genomic level and many loci with high selection coefficients. And so the point is, going back to the thing that Michael mentioned, I mean, this can be actually quite powerful to do further analysis if you want to find a true target of selection. This is the same sketch I've drawn before. So we have the ancestor, and these are different pathways. So now what we see here is, in one replicate, we have a gene being hit here that affects everything down here. In another replicate, we find something that hits a gene that is affecting everything down there. And another one, we may have a different replicate. In another replicate, we have basically target gene in a completely different pathway. But they all point to the same underlying trait that is actually selected. So basically, this heterogeneity in realization of the adaptation to the same whatever higher order phenotype basically takes different paths. And these ones, I think, is a very good idea to use and exploit to find really the target of selection. I also forgot to mention, but Neda will talk more about her data, that if you go for the genes that are covered by these blocks, she finds exactly the same high overlap of the Go categories that we find with the expression data in the other experiment. So the same set of genes seem to be enriched under the targets that you find to be enriched in an expression analysis. So this are the same processes being targeted. So again, we focus on similar things. OK, so now we have thesis, antithesis. We have a conflict. Basically, we have Portugal, United States, convergence for the same high-level traits. We have convergence on the gene level in Portugal. There's basically very little convergence on the gene level in the US. We have few loci with strong effects, and here we have many loci with strong effects. So what do we learn about adaptation? So, I don't know. So should we just say, well, maybe one synthesis would be, yeah, gosh, different founder populations converge to the same phenotypes. This is obvious. And it's also clear that the infinitesimal model can be ruled out for these ones. This seems not to be true. We have major effect loci. The only thing is what differs, how many of these ones we do have. And maybe this is just a matter of the populations. Maybe they have different starting conditions. Who knows? So if you really want to learn something, it's clearly the message will be, you shouldn't just work with a single population. You need to do multiple. And once you've done multiple, maybe you can get an overarching picture of whatever everything could be true. But this would be a bit sobering message. And I think we lose what I would like to have. I would like to have a theory that I could apply to all the populations. And this goes to my synthesis version B, which is extremely speculative, but it's very similar. I finished my talk before Tony was talking, but it goes along the same lines what Tony was talking about. And this is basically we have to get rethink of what are our expectations for selected alleles in these populations. Again, going for thinking that we should maybe consider this in a quantitative genetics framework rather than in a framework of a constant S. So Suse did some simulations on this, basically asking what is the impact on selection trajectories when you have a shift in trait optimum. This means we bring the flies from the wild into the lab where they basically encounter a new temperature environment or a new environment in general. So you change the trait optimum, and how are they responding? And kind of, you can do this. So she kind of custom tailored this to our Drosophila data. And so what you can see here is, of course, in the beginning, when you transfer them, they're quite far away from the trait optimum. And then if you are far away from the trait optimum, and of course, while they're evolving, they get closer to the trait optimum. Once they're here, etc. So what happens to the alleles that are contributing? And this is a very simple scenario. You assume that you have five loci contributing to this, and each locus starts at the same frequency and has the same contribution to the phenotype. And so what you can see is, and this doesn't matter, you could either get the same plot whether you use different loci or different populations. So let's look at one locus in different populations for this. So it could be that in the beginning, when they are far away from the trait optimum, all loci basically, or in all replicates, the same locus moves in the same direction. You see kind of a parallel response. But as soon as they get basically to, they have reached the trait optimum, then suddenly these these alleles or in the different replicates do different things. It's kind of a drift phase or whatever. And then if another locus increases in frequency, then this your focal locus needs to decrease basically to stay at the trait optimum. So it could be that you can get these trajectories here that after some time, this is a very classic result, you fix, because you can't preserve variation with this, But the interesting thing is, beginning, there are three phases. In the beginning, they move in parallel, then they kind of plateau, and then they either go in one direction or the other. So this is
one locus in five different
populations. This is one locus in five different populations, or the same. You get the same picture if you have five loci in the same population. It's the same.
They all have the same selective.
It's the same. It's the same effect size. Same effect size. No vary. Keep it simple. Just to, otherwise, you can mess around with this and get basically everything what you want if you change your parameters.
But you assume you've got other loci under selection at the same time, and you're only tracking one locus.
Exactly. Exactly. It could be the, and if you look in one replicate, you have all the five ones that are contributing to this. She assumed only five. Of course, this depends how much do you change your trade optimum. There are a lot of parameters going into this, but it's a general picture that you're getting. So if you look at our data, what do we see? So we have, this is one block that she has identified, and there are two replicates where we suddenly see that they're going down. So this is exactly something what is difficult to explain with a constant S scenario. We can come up with many other hypotheses. It could be that we had deleterious alleles, and suddenly this is basically the selected locus has recombined away, and the deleterious ones are going down, etc. I find it unlikely because you have a large copy number already here. So if you have recombination events occurring at this phase, you would not see so many responding to this. So you would have recombination at one chromosome, and this may go up, but not all the others. They will still be linked to the beneficial allele. So I don't think so. There is this other issue. This is related to the clustering. If you don't do your clustering right or so, it could be an issue. But I'm saying there is some evidence in the real data that suggests that the alleles are not behaving as you would expect under constant S. And so, going back to the populations that we had, how can we explain this? If you think, for example, one explanation would be that you have loci with different effect sizes. So if you have basically one locus with a huge effect size, other loci with a small effect size, then what would happen? That the locus with big effect size really shoots up and the other ones do very little. So this is a possible outcome. You get a very similar picture if it's not a different effect size, but a different starting frequency. I just didn't have a graph of this. So basically, you also, if one of the loci has a higher starting frequency, then really this one takes off and basically goes to fixation, and the other ones don't show much of a signal of selection. So this is a prediction that you could make if you have alleles starting at different frequencies. Yes, you could explain it, like if you have basically two loci being at a high frequency and the other ones at a low frequency, yes, you may find the response mainly for these two loci. This could be a scenario that could be matching for the Portuguese population. And if you think that these major locus of a big effect size or a big effect size and a high starting frequency would be missing in the other population, then you have a family of other loci that could be contributing to this. Another influence is what you should consider, the number of loci contributing to this. This is when you have 20 loci or 100 loci. You see with 20 loci, you see a much more reproducible pattern in the beginning, but as soon as you ramp up the number of loci to 100, maybe similar to what Neda has been finding, you find huge heterogeneity in the realizations of these 100 loci, how they are behaving in the population. So some of them will make it, some will not make it. So by just having a different number of loci of the same effect could already be a very important factor, also influencing the outcome that you're getting in your experiments. And so I just want to refer to an experiment that Anna has been doing, who's around, so you can torture her more for this. So basically, this is was meant to be our best experiment that we ever done. So we increased the number of founder chromosomes. Basically, it was 400 isofemale lines went into each replicate. We had different subsets, a total 1,200 founders. It was a massive effort to get the flies. This is the largest census population size. And 15 replicates, the most powerful thing what we should have. What you see here is basically nothing. This is one. This is something that we see across all replicates. This is insecticide resistance lockers. I don't want to talk about this. And there is something else here. But otherwise nothing. But if you think on the effect of number of loci, yes, one possible explanation could be because we increase the number of founder chromosomes, and as there, it's the our assumption may have been entirely wrong that there are only a few targets of selection, and the idea was when we have only a few targets of selection, having more founder chromosomes, we find a selected haplotype in different, selected allele in different haplotypes, and therefore it's easier to map the target of selection. This was what the simulation suggested. But if we basically, by adding more chromosomes, we just add more targets of selection, we may, from a scenario of this, move to something like this, plus some other loci with big effect sizes, et cetera, et cetera. So this may explain why this study doesn't show very much. But reality is a bit more complicated, so just to to compare the populations and sum up, it's kind of in Portugal, we have 250 founders. Here we have 205 founders. If we look at the polymorphism, this is a bit less polymorphic than this one. This is the most polymorphic population with most founders. So somehow this could eventually make sense. The starting frequency of the AMPK allele, this is the one with the big sweep signature in in the Portugal population, was 40%. So really indicating this is something that really is doomed to take off. Could also explain why we find a high parallelism there, because if it starts at a high frequency, it will be very reproducible. Also on the quantitative trait scenario, as you've seen for the other, this would make sense. But and in the United States, this selected haplotype, as I said, we identified it, and it's at a very high frequency. So if this is a major contributor, either because of allele frequency or of effect size or a combination of both, in the United States it has no opportunity to contribute to this. And then a hypothesis could be then in the United States we're selecting on a second tier of loci that have no chance to respond in Portugal, or may not be there because we have a lower variation, and so they're not responding there. So we have something that is a very unique pattern because we missed the two major loci. And in South Africa, we also didn't identify, but this is a bit, maybe the haplotype is not preserved. So our hypothesis is the target of selection is also not in South Africa, but in South Africa, on top of this, having we have more variation, more founders, so we may just have more added more loci that are basically beneficial in our environment, and therefore they can't contribute as much as they see. And also, Anna looked into this, and it's really interesting. In South Africa is the population where we have most signatures of sweep starting from us in a single population only, and are restricted to this. And they start at a really low frequency there, because we have more founders, so they could start from a lower frequency. So also, this shows you that the environments are not so different. This shows you, I don't know, what is the maximum temperature, minimum temperature, average temperature, and so across these three populations. So it doesn't look like, as you may think, the environment is so different, but maybe the environment is not so different that this would be an explanation for it. But we still have to work harder to ask what's the starting point of these three founder populations to come up with a better.
Christian, I'm assuming that you're not showing this because it's pretty equivalent for all, but the gains in fitness in all treatments across all founder populations were more or less comparable.
So, sorry, what? I'm not sure I understand.
The gains in fitness. So another explanation is that the U.S. populations, as you argue for AMPK, are very close to some kind of optimum. And so there's not a lot of room to move around. And so you get lots of.
We see an increase in all of them, but the problem is we've done the experiments at different time points. And looking at fecundity, you know what flies? This varies massively when you do your fecundity assay. So we need to all to do them in parallel, and this is something we're just about to do, to see whether this is that we really can see how much they've changed. But the limitation to this is, again, we cannot freeze our flies. So we've started this experiment at three different time points. If we find differences, then it's a mixture of maybe they continue to evolve. Of course, according to a quantitative trait model, they may have reached the optimum already, and then this shouldn't matter any longer, but we have to see. But it's a very valid point, and we have to look into this. That's clear, yeah. Good, and yeah, so basically, as I said, this will be my provocative synthesis B. Portugal, we have two large effect loci of intermediate frequency. Contribution of the other loci cannot be seen if they exist, and we have convergence due to high starting frequency of two major effect loci. In the United States, the two effect loci cannot contribute because they're fixed or absent. This provides room for moderate number of adaptive loci to contribute, and the low starting frequency in combination with epistasis results in low convergence. In South Africa, the two large effect loci cannot contribute because they're presumably not there. More adaptive loci than the United States result in almost no detectable selection signatures because they move only slightly bit, so we cannot detect them. These are the ones that are basically not having so big effect sizes. And then we have some loci with strong effects that are mostly restricted to single replicates. So this will be an attempt to reconcile the results from three different experiments, that each of them was a massive amount of work. And so I'm not inclined to do this for 20 more, but I think it's a very interesting thing. And there, I think, irrespective of what's a true explanation, well, I've shown you first is our data have a link to real ecology, because we find the AMPK in natural populations. This is not an entire lab artifact, and I think we can learn quite something from Drosophila about the genetic architecture of adaptation, because we show that this idea of the infinitesimal model does really not apply for temperature selection in Drosophila, and this should give some more food of thought for modeling adaptive traits in natural populations with having real data that are rather solid compared to some other data that you have where you estimate selection coefficients from natural populations. And so how could you test the synthesis? Idea, so you could try to mix evolved populations and see how are the loci behaving in those ones. This is one thing how you could say, basically you could mix Portugal with Florida. This is one possibility, or that's something we are just doing. We basically do a subset, rather than doing the optimal experiment, combining as many haplotypes as possible, we repeat the experiments with isofemal lines from South Africa, but we do it in different numbers of flies. So we have an experiment starting from 100 isofemal lines and one starting from 25. And so we can subdivide the 100 into basically four groups of 25, and then we can ask which are the selection signatures that we're getting in these subset of 25, and how do they behave in a group of 100. And this would basically hopefully give us more insight on what is the architecture of these loci contributing to this. And again, I would like to acknowledge the people, so now you know a bit more of the work. François has been doing the Portugal work. Anna Maria has been doing the South Africa work. Ray was really instrumental in getting this long-range haplotype linkage disequilibrium going. Suze also was involved in this, and she did the QTL simulations, and Neda's work was basically on the Florida population, which she will give you more details in the last week. Okay, and that's basically it. Yes? So
do you think that if you took that AMPK haplotype that you'd identified in Portugal and introgressed it into a South African population, it would confer any fitness effect?
I would think so, yeah.
I think so, it would a little bit.
I should. Yeah, otherwise, that's exactly what would be a good experiment to do, yeah.
Yeah.
This is going to sound horribly insensitive.
Fair enough.
Because I wonder how much if you had sort of you've done this sort of classical G matrix kind of assessments of the founding population, would you have been able to make better predictions? So you think about things like axes. Of course, you have many phenotypes that you could possibly get. And you've got also ideally it would be a GWAS G matrix. Focus.
But my question is what phenotype to look at? What is the phenotype?
Now that you know. Now I don't know. Have some phenotypes.
I don't know. Okay, you could look at CO2 production or whatever, but you don't want to do this. This is
I just think these plenty of populations will presumably differ in the axes of genetic variation available to them in a purely quantitative genetic sense. And that's supposed to be predictive of the follow-up passive they follow, and would that
Yeah, but you don't do this on a population level. You would do it on an individual level. And then what is the right individual level? Would you inbreed your individuals? And then you start with really inbred individuals for which we know they behave very strangely. So then you, if you have enough resources, you could do it. And if you think you have the right phenotype, I would think what we really need to do next is we really need to get down to the real targets of selection. It's not CO2 production. This is a correlated trait. Fitness is a correlated trait. So I think we really need to go down to the trait that really makes the flies fitter. And I think once you have these ones, then you could start thinking about exactly what you're saying. If we have a way that we could measure the real trait, then this may become more realistic rather than guessing and looking for something correlated and then getting, yeah?
But how do we know?
If that's what you think is the right thing to do, then was all this a waste of time? Like, should you have just taken your Florida and Maine flies and crossed them with some giant F3 and then hired a bunch of physiologists to just dissect out what's making you more fit?
If you think that, I focused on one of these signatures that gave us the nicest results from the expression data, but this is not everything what's going on there. So that's true. But of course, with hindsight, it's not all physiology. We see many other responses as well that I haven't detailed so much because they come from different pieces of information and all this. We see other phenotypes that are also responding in the hot evolved fly. So it's not just physiology.
So I totally agree with you. We want to know which traits are the real targets of selection, but how will we figure this out? How can we know? So many things are correlated. You could all just sort of reason to yourself, oh, this could help, this could help. What do you think?
Yeah, but I think the idea, all what you need to have is a high throughput screening of your traits. If you have a way to do high throughput screening of traits, you can really take advantage of these replicates with a having been taken different paths. And then all what you need to look is for phenotype that is basically consistent across all the 10 replicates. Because
you do it empirically. You screen for many traits, and whichever...
That's my way how I would do it. If you have another way, I'm...
No, I don't know. It would be...
But I think this is... Way. It's just a different mindset, like, because we have been going always, well, we should go for the genetic signal, this is what I spent my career on.
Let's take a look at it.
And I'm getting a bit... saying, well... Particularly for Portugal, it's so consistent at so many things. I will not understand what's really changing there. And the thing is, having the AMPK, it's a hugely pleiotropic gene affecting many pathways. So I will not really know what changes are really required to give the flies a better survival in the hot environment.
But even if you trace those phenotypes as much as you can, they may be different in the US and in Portugal even. Because, for instance, if the EMPK is fixed somehow in the US, you may have secondary effects. You know, once you have this one that is almost fixed, that you have secondary effects that are quite different from the first one you get.
But what makes me wonder that this may not be the case, because I said the genomic signal seems to show the same response as we see on the transcriptome. So it seems also to be that the metabolism is responding in the US flies. And so I think it may be a metabolite, say ATP or whatever, that is the true target of selection. But this you need to check. You're right. The other thing could be that you have a very different way of doing this, but I would start, my way would be, I would start with the population where you have all the flies from the same genetic background but evolve differently and get the target then, and then use this target and ask what is this target doing in the other populations. And this would answer your question better than my arm waving.
But you're still going to have all these correlated, it still seems, I mean, the whole point of doing the genetics is that you can separate out the correlated responses, like all the transcriptional changes that you already observed, right? Even in that your simplest case, you saw all these downstream transcriptional changes that are presumably not causal from
these ones you can't sort out with the genetics any longer. That's exactly the problem.
Well, the way to do it is, so everything in these things, I mean, so I'll be presenting the same stuff. It's all correlational, so at some point, the way to do it is to do, you have to do some genetics in addition. And
I'm not disagreeing with this.
Yeah,
I'm not disagreeing with this.
Because I think when you look for your traits now, what you'll find is that many, many traits change, and you still won't know whether or not they're causal.
But I also find that many genes change. Like, a gene is, this gene changes, this one, and they all do the same job.
Well, exactly. So somehow they, well, in this
and for this, I think you're better off in finding what they have in common if you look for the same, whatever, metabolite or expression pattern that is basically a consequence of the change of these genes.
I agree. So that's sort of the question, is at what level is the systems? Because this is not surprising to me that this would be true. So the question is at what level of aggregation in what system we can define these changes. I have one other question, though, that goes back to the distribution of the S's. Because this is a big problem, not a problem, it's confusing. So if you take a multiplicative model on these kinds of things, then the cost of selection would have to be something like only 1 in 1,000 individuals surviving or less under this kind of selection estimate. So is that possible in your population? In your populations, given the sizes that you have, or, and then this goes to the later part of your talk when you talked about the quantitative genetic model, can we have strong selection because it's a shifting pattern of selection over time or something like that? There's something incongruous about how strong selection is, and then how much depth it would be required to impose that selection.
I don't think it's so implausible. The sensor size we have, it depends. Well, I can't even tell you on which developmental stage I do have this selection. That's the thing. But clearly what we have is more, we have more larvae and eggs than we do have adults. So I think there's massive opportunity for selection on the larval stage. Because we're not controlling density so well.
Yeah.
So I think we have certainly massive number of individuals.
Yeah, but what Patrick
but there's a, there's
that
upper limit of
fecundity. At the time of reproduction, you should do a calculation, assuming additivity.
I don't know, but what?
So selection zombie still going around?
Well, whatever it is.
There's no fly that has all the good things, and it's just not an issue.
Right? I think it's worth to think about it, but I don't think it's such a big issue because it's not the number of individuals that are basically. Then basically reproducing because you have selection.
I'm not sure what your comment was. That sounded like a genetic load comment. This is how much change can you generate in a population, allele frequency change, in so much amount of time. It has nothing to do with there being a perfect non-mutant individual. That's a separate argument about cost of selection.
Yeah, but then there is sort of no need to kill 99.99% of all individuals every generation to make that happen, right?
And then it's not additive because you're only a quantitative trait.
That's different.
So short term, they have these effects for the early on, but maybe there's epistasis for the second round. And so
exactly, that's what I said. Yeah, so that's certainly possible, but one needs to figure out what it is. There's just a lot of selection being generated at 100 different loci. So this is the part of the thing when one talks to a general audience. This is one of the questions that comes up. What is the model that allows that much selection to be maintained over this short amount of time in this small population, and so on and so forth? These cannot be dismissed out of hand, I would say, by calling them zombies or whatever. This is a true issue that we need to, as a field, we need to figure out what's going on.
I'm not disagreeing. On the other hand, we also have to see that we get our models right.
Well,
contradicts the model, but here we have hard data,
exactly.
and that's what's the exciting thing about it, because now you have something to substantiate and think about how this happens.
I'm going to show exactly the same thing, so it's worth thinking about. If the expectations are incorrect, then something different must be going on.
It's really about how many alleles are changing, it's like how much frequency over how much.
Okay, one last question, and we should have coffee.
So when you say it all go to the same phenotypes, The thing is, we measured the number of phenotypes, and in the end, some phenotypes are correlated anyway, so you end up with the same kind of mess than with the genetic data, because a lot of them are correlated.
These high-order phenotypes, yes. But I think you could eventually go down to, like...
Okay, my question is, like, some of the phenotypes would be correlated because it's adaptive correlation. Those correlations emerge from adaptation. Mm-hmm. And some other phenotypes will be correlated just by constraint, right? How do you think you would disentangle between the correlated phenotypes that emerge from adaptation from those that emerge from constraint? I mean, do you need to compare different populations?
Well, the point is the ones that are the idea is high FS is 10 replicates, but we can discuss this maybe over coffee.
Okay.
Yeah, I would say maybe 10 past 11, just to give you some opportunity to get your coffee.